Hit it.
Hey, everyone. We just finished recording another Left of Boom episode with an attorney from Seyfarth, Dawn Reddy Soloway. Dawn has a super interesting background, and she heads up Seyfarth's Cultural Flashpoints Task Force, which is a really interesting group helping employers navigate these, you know, incredibly sort of tumultuous times that we have. We talk about things like the vaccine mandates, DEI, that we've got a big presidential election coming up, and a lot of the conflicts that occur at work, you know, center around some of these cultural flashpoints. She gives some really great practical tips on how employers can navigate some of these difficult times. We hit some of our favorite stuff to do in Boston. It's a great episode. Next Left of Boom Show with Dawn Reddy Soloway. Enjoy.
Good morning. It's Michael Vandervoort, and this is another episode of the Left of Boom Show. Today, we're going to kind of pivot off the presidential debate from a couple nights ago and talk about like burning
issues. There was a debate a couple nights ago? I missed it.
I didn't even ask you if you watched it. I actually did watch it, and it was amazing.
Sorry.
Divisiveness in the country, cultural flashpoints, lots of people with strong opinions that differ and cause consternation and discord in the workplace. And we have somebody here who kind of specializes in helping employers deal with that today, and that's our guest, Dawn Reddy Soloway. Dawn, welcome to Left the Boom Show. How are you?
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, hi, Dawn. It's great to have you.
We're glad to have you. Go ahead, Phil. Sorry, I'm
talking. I just said it's great to have her on the show.
So, Dawn, let's start out. I always start out just by basically asking, rather than reading a bio and all this stuff, you do litigation, you do a lot of religious accommodation, a lot of different things. But why don't you tell us about yourself and your bio and what you do, and then we'll jump into the topic of the day.
Absolutely. Thanks. So I am Dawn Reddy Soloway. I am a partner at Seyfarth Shaw in our Boston office in the Labor and Employment Group. So I am an employment litigator and counselor for clients all around the country. I do have specialized expertise in trials and appeals, as well as religious accommodation and discrimination. And I am the co-chair of our Cultural Flashpoints Task Force.
Which is going to be the subject of a good chunk of our conversation today. Before we go down that rabbit hole, however, we always like to start out our show with a question that comes out of the leadership work that Phil has done in the past and some of his books on approachability. And that is, could you share with us a person or persons that may have influenced you and mentored you through your career at a time maybe when they believed in you more than you believed in yourself, or, you know, that brought you some special aspect that helped you be successful?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm thinking of, mentors in female mentors in the jury trial space, because there are not as many women who try cases as there are men. And I think the first person I could think of is when I was in high school, I did an internship at the Legal Services Clinic in Worcester, Massachusetts, where I grew up. And that was really my first exposure to law. I think I was 16. And to the courtroom, and I got to go to court every day with this legal services attorney who was a woman, and was just absolutely blown away by the fact that this was her job and that she got to do this as her work. And she was very encouraging about, you know, kind of how, you know, I had all kinds of questions about, you know, how do you get trained to be able to do this. So I would say her for sure. And then at my original first law firm out of law school, Judy Malone, who some people in Boston may know, she's sort of a trial lawyer legend here. And she was a real mentor to me around, you know, kind of courtroom practice. We tried cases together when I was a very junior associate, and I learned a lot from her. And then my final one would be a Seyfarth lawyer named Lynn Kappelman, who is the chair of our national trial team and an incredibly gifted trial lawyer. We've tried lots of cases together, and I have just learned so much from her. So those would be my choices. And I certainly try to encourage younger women in the firm to, you know, pursue trial work, you know, and be a mentor myself to those.
That legal services work is like so challenging and so important. My roommate, my third year of law school, that's what he went into when he got out of law school. And that work is, I'm not sure that I would have been like inspired to go into law watching a lot of those cases, but that is some of the most important legal work that is done.
Absolutely. And I went on in college to volunteer at Greater Boston Legal Services for that same reason. Incredibly important work, and still an organization that I support when I can.
Cool. Mentoring other lawyers, just maybe just a quick tip or two for, you know, what do you do to like encourage and grow young talent?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have a program at Seyfarth called the Trial Advocacy Institute that trains associates in trial practice. And I, you know, encourage all of our associates to take part in that, but particularly some of the women who may not, have sort of thought of themselves as potential trial lawyers. And last year in Chicago, we hosted a full-blown mock trial where senior members of the trial team mentored individual teams, and we had a full mock trial with judges and then kind of practice, you know, tips. And it was a lot of fun, and I think we all learned a lot. I know I certainly learned a lot from the other mentors to the other teams. And so that's been a great program, and I think a great way to encourage kind of the next generation of trial lawyers here at Seyfarth.
Cool.
Nice. When I was a undergrad student, I aspired to go to law school. I never did, but I did an internship at a landlord tenant legal aid clinic in the city of Detroit. And it was the court rate of, you know, deciding in favor of landlords was like 94% or something. And most of the time the law was on their side, but I had a case, and I did intake work, right? I was writing up cases, and I stupidly and naively, because I was not a law student at the time, took a case in and walked down the hall and filed a motion on behalf of the client for a consent decree, to contest a consent decree. And then I went and told the director of the clinic that I had filed this motion, and he's like, "What?" Because you had to be a law student, right? I'm like, "Well, I did all the work, you know." And he goes, "Oh, crap." So he goes running down the hall and has to go down and re-enter everything, but he comes back and says, "You did a great job on that, actually." I was like, "That, well, I'm sorry, I didn't know I couldn't, I wasn't empowered to do it."
That was awesome, except for the malpractice part.
All except for the part where you're about to violate our very operational reason for existence. Yeah, so, like I said, I was kind of naive and passionate about helping this lady. It was a big deal. Anyway, well, thanks for sharing that. I was thinking about the litigation piece, because that, like, that's a special, it's not a specialty, but like we talk to a lot of employment lawyers, but in labor law, which is a bit different from the area of employment law that you practice in on a regular basis, we don't go to litigation so much. I mean, there's obviously board charges and stuff. So I just take us down that, like, what, like, how do you help clients with litigation? And, you know, is it better, you know, like, can you just walk us through some of the high level stuff there for a second, since that's an area that we don't touch on a lot with our listeners?
Sure, yeah. I mean, in the employment space, you know, the cases typically start at the charge stage at the EEOC or a state equivalent agency. And then from there, often we'll proceed to either federal or state court. And so, you know, Seyfarth does the full gamut of, you know, either defending those charges, defending single plaintiff cases in state and federal court, as well as class actions, for example, in the wage and hour space, in both state and federal court. So it's a wide range of litigation that we practice.
And you've had a kind of a big jump up in kind of out of the pandemic, right? In vaccination cases and religious accommodation stuff that kind of spawned, not necessarily new, but like a whole new angle on that, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, I've long had an expertise in religious accommodation and discrimination, but I always say that it used to be a very sleepy little area of the law where, you know, occasionally somebody would want to wear a yarmulke to work or, you know, need a break for prayer or a Sunday off for worship. And then in 2021, when the pandemic was in full, you know, on full display, many of our clients adopted mandatory vaccination policies and saw a just huge surge of requests for religious exemption from those vaccination policies. So we had clients that, you know, might have 100 or 1,000, 10,000, 25,000 requests for religious exemption, which is way beyond anything that they were able to, you know, handle in many cases internally with their existing HR teams. And so we kind of stood up in real time. I mean, this was a 24/7 process back in 2021 of helping clients to process all of those requests for accommodation, religious and medical accommodation, and had to really design kind of innovative processes to manage that number of requests and make sure that each one was individually reviewed and according to best practices. And then not too long after that, we started to see litigation arising out of those denials where an employee was denied a exemption request and in some cases was either put on leave or terminated. Many of those employees filed suits, and those suits, believe it or not, are still coming in at a fairly rapid clip. And many of them are still in litigation that were filed back in 2021 or 2022. So, you know, Seyfarth is we're litigating those cases all around the nation.
It's crazy that it takes so long, but
yes.
You said you stood up in real time. So there was like a vaccination. You had like you guys used this task force idea, which fascinates me because I haven't seen other law firms do it. And that takes us kind of, I saw that you were involved in one that was involved around vaccinations and accommodations. And then in the last year or two, you've also pivoted to this cultural flashpoints task force that we're going to talk about. So let's go there. And first about talk about like why you took the approach you did with a task force and what that looks like, and then sort of what the issues are, and we'll go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, so you're exactly right that we did have a vaccine task force back in 2021, and that was really just designed to help our clients around the country because of this extreme volume and because the vaccine exemptions raised so many novel questions of first impression that you know, our clients were really looking for guidance. And so we set up a task force, which was sort of run by partners across the firm who had you know, particular areas of expertise that intersected with vaccines. And then we're also trained a ton of associates in helping clients to manage these processes. We had a technology approach to it too, a sort of innovative way of helping clients to manage those, that huge volume of, so that was the vaccine task force. And then I think, you know, what happened with the Cultural Flashpoints Task Force is in about mid 2023, you know, kind of still litigating all of the vaccine cases, but we kind of, you know, I guess to step back, you know, Seyfarth has this culture of innovation. That's one of the things that, you know, we stand out for our history of innovation. And part of that is kind of looking in a new, fresh way at what clients are facing and trying to sort of stand in their shoes so that we can be true partners with them. And in 2023, we were recognizing that there were all of these ways that polarization that was out there in society was coming inside the workplace. So vaccines were a perfect example, right? There was vaccines were politicized. They were, you know, discussed a lot in the media. There were these different factions. There were all this misinformation about vaccines in terms of the ingredients and efficacy and safety. And that came in a very direct and real way into the workplace in the form of these exemption requests. But we were seeing it not just in the vaccine space, but in, for example, challenges to DEI programs, mm-hmm. or conflicts between religious rights and LGBTQ rights, or other protected classes. And so we sort of set out to say, like, how do we help clients think about the ways in which polarization are coming into the workplace? And, you know, of course, we were even back in 2023 anticipating that this was going to be an election year. Here we are. So we assembled the idea of the task force is we assembled a group of experts from around the firm in these different areas. So religious accommodation, DEI, LGBTQ issues, other areas of expertise, and kind of brought them together to think about how we could best help clients in this space.
I think it's interesting. I'm curious your comment about, I mean, it's become sort of a strategy to, like, DEI is a great example where, you know, that one kind of political move is to start a bunch of litigation, you know, related to, you know, it could be vaccines, but DEI is a great example. Kind of walk us through a little bit about what is it like being on the front lines of this sort of giant, you know, litigation strategy to just really just seems like to create political points.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that, we are now in a space where the political and the litigation are very much overlapping. We saw that in the vaccine space where many of the religious exemption requests were downloaded from the internet. And were, you know, kind of ghostwritten by political or religious groups. And we certainly see something similar in the DEI space and continuing in religious accommodation requests now kind of pivoting more away. A lot of clients employers have revised their vaccine policies because the pandemic has changed and the science has changed, the vaccines have changed. Mm-hmm. But religious accommodation requests continue to come in and have just sort of morphed into, different trends that we're seeing. But those are still very much driven by political and religious groups in many cases.
How, I should know the answer to this, but like, how important is it that my accommodation request is actually like firmly held personally versus it aligns with my political viewpoint?
It's a great question. So the basic sort of super high level law here is that the employee has to show a sincere religious conflict with a workplace rule. And if they do, then the employer has to engage in an interactive process to see if they can offer a reasonable accommodation without incurring undue hardship. So when they're processing a request, it's really about looking at, is this a sincere, one, sincere, two, religious, three, conflict with a workplace rule, and using the interactive process to try to get at those issues. So if something is, for example, completely political, completely secular, I don't want to come to work on Sunday because I have my kid's soccer game, right? That's completely secular. In some cases, you know, I don't want to take a vaccine because I just don't believe that my employer should be telling me what to do with my body. That's really more of a political stance as opposed to something that is religious in nature. But it can be tricky to find those lines, and that's where we help clients, kind of navigate some of those tricky distinctions.
Yeah.
So as you brought this task force of sort of like, is this all within the employment law universe, basically? You're not bringing in, okay. So employment lawyers with different sort of disciplinary expertise, as you bring them together, you said you're trying to figure out how to help clients, like, I guess, holistically. How did you approach that, and what kind of stuff do you do besides, you know, the client lawyer relationship, right? What else are you doing and stuff? But let's talk about examples.
We help clients in lots of ways. I mean, and the task force is really designed to share information and make sure that we are leveraging, the depth and breadth of our expertise from across the firm to these complex problems that clients have. So we do a lot of counseling of clients where they have an immediate flashpoint. Oh my God, this has erupted today, and we need help figuring out, what to do next. We also do a lot of training. So I was in Chicago yesterday, training a group of about 30 in-house employment lawyers in kind of how to develop a framework within the organization to think about how to handle flashpoints. And so we do that sort of training. And then we also do litigate cases that arise out of these kinds of flashpoints when they become a EEOC charge or a lawsuit. And I should add also investigations. We sometimes help clients where, there might be a complaint about a flashpoints issue and the employer needs to do an investigation. And that's also something that we will either guide from a legal perspective or serve as a third party investigator in those matters.
Michael, I've got, there's a place where this intersects with our day mm-hmm. job and like with the NLRA and the NLRB. There's been a lot of controversy, certainly on the management bar side, around the NLRB is pretty much kind of anything goes as far as speech in the workplace. They're very, very reluctant to call anything sort of out of bounds and not protected by their statute, which comes into conflict often with the EEO rules around workplace civility and an employer that wants to enforce a workplace, where respectful conversations happen, especially around topics of, race or sex. Just curious, what's your feeling about that?
It's an excellent point and something that we are is very much part of our work on the Flashpoints Task Force. So, I talked about a framework. So what we help clients to do is think about a sort of cohesive, consistent, customized framework that their organization will use to navigate flashpoints. Kind of a through line. So rather than reacting one by one to individual flashpoints, kind of creating a framework for thinking about these issues. And that will include, I say customized because it's really going to vary from employer to employer. So it's going to depend on sort of what are their corporate values and mission, what are their policies, but then also what does the law say? And to your point, what the law says can be tricky and sometimes in conflict. So we help clients think through a couple of different layers of legal analysis. One is the Title VII, so federal non-discrimination law. But then also, what is the risk under the NLRA? Is the speech protected concerted activity? Is it either unionized or non-unionized workplace? Mm-hmm. And then also there's an additional layer of state law, just to make things more complicated, because when you talk about either off-duty conduct or political expression, there are frequently state laws that can apply. So what we try to do is sort of help clients think about those different areas of legal risk, and then think about what are the practical options that are compliant with those intersecting laws, but also consistent with the company's mission and policies, and not just minimizing legal risk, but also protecting the company reputation, keeping morale up so that you're retaining the best talent, mm-hmm. Just making sure that employees are actually focused on the work. Because one thing that we find in flashpoints is that, sometimes there's so much, chaotic, polarization within a particular workforce, maybe on Slack or Jabber or in the workplace or in other settings, that, the management is sort of throwing up their hands and saying, nobody's doing the work that we mm-hmm. need them to be doing. So we try to come from a sort of a holistic approach, those kinds of flashpoints.
Okay, great.
So there's tons of examples of around DEI, especially where companies have kind of gone out, been more progressive in their approach, perhaps, and Now they're now with this sort of discord and public pressure from one side or another, they retrench, right? Do you guys talk to your clients about like consistency and, you know, maintaining? Because it's tough if you get one of these boycotts or one of these sort of, you know, hot 24-hour periods where everybody's blasting your brand on all over social media. How do you help clients with that kind of stuff?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And I think, you know, that's why I come back to sort of this framework, because, you know, we encourage clients to think through in advance a proactive and consistent approach. And so sometimes they employers will develop their own kind of internal flashpoints task force, if you will. And we will help them decide who are going to be the stakeholders who are participants in that, and help them provide, you know, help provide them like hypotheticals, for example, that real life cases that we've seen, how would they handle that internally? And that way they are developing something that is consistent and that is not reactive. Because just as you said, when a flashpoint erupts and it's on Twitter, and you've got, you know, 1,000 of the same email coming in from the public or customers, you know, it's difficult sometimes for clients not to panic. And so we sort of encourage just to have a proactive approach in advance, so that you've already got an internal team that's assembled, that's aware of the legal parameters, and that kind of has thought through an approach, which, you know, then of course you have to customize to that specific situation, but you're not sort of starting from scratch as the flashpoint is erupting on X.
Right.
And part of that strategy probably includes accepting that we're going to get some litigation, right? It's like, if we, you know, if we're going to hold on to this position, and just like go back to that example of, you know, if you insist on sort of workplace civility and those type, you know, we're going to really focus on kind of the EEO side of things. You're accepting the risk that if the NLRB were to ever kind of look at what you're doing, they're probably going to find policies that they feel like infringe on protected concerted activity, because they can't really get clear on how these two statutes are going to play together. And the client then just has to sort of understand, same thing with DEI. It's like, if you're going to lean in on DEI, you're at risk of either a bad PR, you know, campaign or potentially litigation over the stance that you've taken. And you just kind of have to, like, if that's consistent with your values and everything, that just seems kind of like where you're starting with is like, okay, what's the framework? And then inside that framework, there's going to be bad things are going to happen probably, but we're going to respond to it in a culturally, you know, effective way.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's fascinating about the flashpoints work is that the answer is going to be different for every client, because there is different levels of risk aversion and different priorities. And but I will say that, you know, I think, for example, since we've been talking about DEI, you know, our view is that there companies can absolutely stay true to their DEI mission despite the challenges. And we see lots of clients doing that. And it's really more about, you know, not so much walking it back, but really just being thoughtful about, again, being proactive about, you know, for example, looking at, you know, the external facing public statements that the company is making about DEI, looking at what does the website say, because that's where some of these groups are sort of trolling to, you know, to look for defendants. And also just auditing, you know, your programs, your DEI programs, to make sure that they're compliant with the law. And if you do that, then it is definitely workable to maintain a robust DEI program, which is so important to so many companies, you know, to make sure that they're attracting and retaining the best and most, you know, best talent from across the board. But you're absolutely right that the risk appetite is one, you know, one of many things that we help clients consider when they're kind of creating that framework.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was just going to add
that, you know, in terms of policies, I think one of the things that we would encourage, the companies to do is to really take a look at their policies to make sure, you know, if you've got a political expression policy from 5 years ago, like you got to take a new, fresh look at that in 2024 because it's just a completely different world. Same thing with religious accommodation. You know, I find that a lot of times companies have really well thought out, robust disability accommodation policies and templates, and then nothing for religious accommodation because, like I said, it used to be a sleepy area of the law. You know, it used to be something where maybe you'd get one or two a year, and but that's just not the landscape anymore. And so, helping companies to think through kind of updating their suite of policies to make sure they're ready for the present moment.
Yeah, like in my career, I literally had maybe like two religious accommodation requests, and they were early on. They were like 20 years ago. I was in a position, you know, in the recent years that we just talked about since the pandemic, where I didn't touch that kind of stuff. So it wasn't that they didn't exist in the companies that I was at. I just didn't deal with them. But I feel very fortunate that I didn't have to like live in the trenches of HR in what you've talked about in the last 3 or 4 years, because I know some of my colleagues at my former employer were buried with that kind of stuff. I'm curious, Dawn, in the real time moment, like we kind of joked around at the beginning, oh, what, there was a debate the other day. So obviously there's, you know, an election coming up. There's, you know, you're still dealing with stuff that's 3 or 4 years old in terms of litigation. What are the real hot button? Like, what are you hearing? You know, what are employers on the phone calling you about today? And your task force, what do you view as the hot button items of today? And then following up on that, and what tips can you offer employers to help deal with those? Because that's probably what they're seeing on the ground.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's interesting because the issue of the day does kind of morph a little bit every couple of weeks to according to what's happening out in the world. Certainly ever since October 7th of last year, there has been just a pretty constant wave of questions around, post October 7th. Sometimes that looks like disputes inside the workplace. Sometimes it's concern about social media postings, outside speakers who come in, ostensibly to speak about a particular topic and kind of veer off into talking about the Israel-Hamas war. So that is a persistent theme. I know, last spring, there were a lot of questions about, do we have to hire students who were in the encampments? And now with students returning to campus, I think there's a renewed kind of, series of questions about protest activity and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned the debate. I think, what we're seeing, and it's so interesting how things, phrases and topics that are out there in the campaign are immediately inside the workplace. So as an example, the term DEI hire, which many of us find to be a very offensive term, is something that's ripped right out of the campaign. And so it's very easy for employees to be talking about, what did you think of that in the debate last night? And then having that topic kind of morph into talking about the workplace that, the employees are in and who's a DEI hire at our company. And as you can imagine, things can go really south really quickly, in that space. So, lots of questions that are coming into the workplace from the campaign and, whatever the, issue or phrase of the day is, for sure.
And so how do employers deal with that? Like, what do you recommend, short term, and obviously besides calling you?
like I said, I think taking a real hard look at policies to make sure they're updated to meet the moment. And that's not just sort of discrimination policies, but, look at where your flashpoints are erupting in your workplace. So I never in my life thought that I would have so many questions about Zoom backgrounds. That is, for whatever reason, an area where people like to broadcast their political thoughts. They'll put Free Palestine or I Stand with Israel on their Zoom background, which leads to sometimes, either people being offended inside the workplace, or sometimes customers feeling like, wait a minute, is this the company's position? So that's an area, for example, where you might say, okay, this is really creating a lot of chaos and division in our workspace. And so we're going to look at our virtual background policy. And, you know, you have to use the company's virtual background, or, please make sure that it's professional and neutral, or don't alter the company Zoom background. So policies are a big issue. And then I would say the secret weapon of cultural flashpoints is training. So making sure, you know, at multiple levels, first of all, that the in-house legal team is really aware of those different layers that we talked about of intersecting laws of Title VII, NLRA, and state law, and some of the sort of common areas of dispute and tension. And then also making sure that the frontline managers are aware, right? Because people, they may not be aware, for example, that the standard for religious accommodation changed, in 2023 in a unanimous Supreme Court decision. And, you know, so those managers or HR people who are intersecting with those religious accommodations really need to know the current framework so that they're, exercising a compliant process. Training and then workforce training. So we have, Seyfarth has a training subsidiary called Seyfarth at Work. And our Cultural Flashpoints Task Force has partnered with Seyfarth at Work to create a workforce broad training about how to sort of navigate cultural differences in cultural beliefs to have a respectful workplace. And, you know, a lot can be done on the front end to sort of train employees about not everyone thinks like you. Not everyone in the company necessarily agrees with you on these things. People in Boston may not think the same way as people in Texas or Missouri. And training can do a lot to sort of sensitize people to those issues, and is really just a great investment so that you're not kind of doing cleanup later. And it reduces the chance of litigation.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Anything else on your end, Phil?
It's a good defense as well, right? Like you'd show, hey, we've trained everybody on how to do this. Like that's, there's value.
Absolutely.
In that as well. So yeah, great.
Yes.
First of all, I want to say thank you for doing this. We're running up on the end of our time here. So thanks for doing this. This was great discussion.
Yeah, thank you.
I look forward to having it up on the website. I'd like to, we always close with like a fun question. We're handicapped because Phil and I are in Oklahoma. We're far from New England. And so I'm not sure my question was fair to us, but.
Yeah, we're sandwiched between those two states that you just named that are different than Boston. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly. We're flyover country. So the question I came up with for regionally is, what's your favorite spot in Boston or New England? And how does it connect to the themes we've talked about today, since the birthplace of the country was a revolution that came out of that part of the world? So I don't know if we can tie that together in a good way or not, but let's take a shot at it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with Fenway Park, which I think actually does relate to cultural flashpoints, if you'll just bear with me. Fenway Park is a place where it's a historic and, storied place. But it also is a place that really brings people together of every possible, background, race, age, you name it. And for this sort of common purpose of, rooting
of
for
yelling
the Red Sox.
At Yankees fans.
Occasionally. I think is an apt place for this topic because, kind of a reminder that there is a lot that we all have in common, even if we may have really strong disagreements on certain topics. And I think that's what employers really want to try to tap into to maintain respectful and collaborative workplaces in our polarized time.
Great answer. That's great.
What about you, Phil?
My favorite place in Boston?
Or New England or whatever.
New
Yeah.
England. Before my daughter was born, we had like a great trip. I'll never, my wife was so sick, but it was, but we were went up to New Hampshire. We saw like my best friend from high school. We had like a great time. But I love Boston. Boston has, if I had to, I would probably like veer toward food. So, like a good crab roll or lobster roll, some oysters that, I mean, like you just, wherever you turn, there's great seafood.
Absolutely. Well, our office is in the Seaport district in Boston, and so we've got lots of amazing seafood restaurants overlooking the water. So you'll have to visit next time you're in Boston.
Yeah, will
So
do.
one of my favorite things to do is to go whale watching. And so I've been out of Plymouth and Provincetown, right? And I thought, both of those are very apt. I've seen, like, I went out of Provincetown, I don't know, a decade ago, and saw like 27 humpback whales in 3 hours, including a mother and her calf. It was amazing. And I was up in New England a year or so ago, and had a similar day out of Plymouth. And of course, Plymouth, the Pilgrims landed in Plymouth, and the country, I guess the rock isn't real. Plymouth Rock isn't a real thing, but it's a nice tourist trap. And then, of course, Provincetown has its own unique flair that makes it a really cool. So I think those apply a bit to cultural flashpoints, and that we've seen a lot of history come up. So that was a stretch on that question, but well, thanks very much, Don. And I want to thank you again. And we're going to go ahead. I just wondered if you had any final thoughts you wanted to add. Otherwise, we'll wrap.
No other than, if employers are wrestling with these issues, we're here to help, and people can feel free to reach out to me at my office at Cypress Shaw.
Awesome. And we'll have that information in the show notes. Thanks for
Yeah.
doing this.
Don,
Thanks so
thanks
much
so
for having me.
much. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, bye.